Stay tuned for The Cinema Clash, as Maryland-based critics Charlie Jewell and Hannah Buchdahl debate the merits of new releases, from the mainstream movies that Hannah tends to favor to obscure foreign films that Charlie likes to champion. It's free-flowing, unedited conversation with an occasional wine wager. Two very different perspectives, one entertaining podcast. Let the clash begin.
Hello and welcome to The Cinema Clash. I'm Charlie Jewell of charliejewell.com.
And I'm Hannah Buchdahl of chickflix.net.
It is the Yuletide season, therefore we're being a little bit sneaky. Holiday season means holiday parties, and when we usually do this on Fridays, I have a holiday party. Therefore, we're doing this on a Wednesday.
Therefore,
no
wine, no
alcohol. No alcohol. So let's just jump right in. You told me this week, we need to do a blockbuster. Why do we need to do a blockbuster?
Because it was really only one of only two films actually coming out this week. And so I expected you to try and attend the biggest movie release of the week.
Is it though?
Yes.
I'm sure Jumanji colon The Next Level. But let me ask. I did see Jumanji colon Welcome to the Jungle. And it was really funny. Jack Black playing a teenage girl, the whole thing. Is my favorite character, Ruby Roundhouse, the killer of men, still in Jumanji?
She is. I mean, Jumanji, The Next Level, really picks up about a year after the end of Welcome to the Jungle. And I had not seen Welcome to the Jungle until this week. Mm. I purposely rented it and watched it so that I would have the proper foundation to go into the sequel.
Did you need to see the first
Absolutely.
One? Otherwise, you wouldn't know.
You'd know, but you would not really get all the great lines, the inside jokes. There's nods to previous things, and the same for the most part. The gang is back together, and so while this is not nearly as good as Welcome to the Jungle, The Next Level is still very entertaining, and it's a really fun ensemble. And I everyone in the theater really did enjoy it. There was a lot of laughter going on, but it also has heart, and that was in the first film as well. And so this is going to be big.
Is it because the really big jokes, you know, the weakling nerd became Dwayne the Rock Johnson, and that was funny? But it's only funny. It was, you know, it's only funny for so long. It really can't be funny anymore. Fridge, the football player, becomes tiny little Kevin Hart. That's funny in the first one, but it can't be funny anymore.
Exactly. And there's a twist. And so unless you actually see it, Charlie, then you don't know what the twist is to understand how they could pull it off. And so it does reunite.
I'm going to guess they select different characters for the game.
Not really.
All right.
But it does reunite the four teenagers who in the first one, you know, stumbled across this Jumanji game that was somehow converted from a board game into a video game. But they're back together. They've been off at college. They'd gone their separate ways. And they are all coming home for winter break. And Spencer, who really was the...
He's the leader.
He is sort of in this freshman funk. And so he comes back and they're all supposed to get together, but Spencer's a no-show. And they come to discover that Spencer, for various reasons, has just sort of ventured back into this very dangerous game. And so they follow. But two additional new players get sucked in, which is Spencer's grandpa Eddie, Danny DeVito, and Eddie's sort of estranged friend Milo, Danny Glover. And that infuses some fresh blood. Awkwafina is a new avatar in this new world order of Jumanji in the new game. So there's enough to make it different. Kevin Hart and Dwayne Johnson, they are back in full form, and they are just fun to watch. They really are. And the idea that these avatars can kind of take on the personalities of these teenagers, or in some cases perhaps older people, and pull off kind of playing them in all these different ways. It's creative, and it's just a family-friendly fun ride. And so I think, again, while it's not as good as its predecessor, it's good enough to be pretty darn huge at the box office.
Some people were very turned off when Welcome to the Jungle came out. They were, the original Jumanji, I remember from like 96. It wasn't that long
ago.
Robin
Williams.
And there's like, they're already remaking these video game films. Hollywood is so uncreative now, so unoriginal. It's just eating its own and turning it back into something 20 years later. I see where they're coming from. I get it. And now it made so much money. Oh my God, Welcome to the Jungle made so much money. They had to make a sequel. And it sounds like they really did. I believe you that it's funny. The first one was funny, but all they did was they shook the die a little bit and they played Yahtzee and
sure.
We'll spice it up with grumpy old men, throw in the hottest girl right now, Awkwafina, and there you go.
Hey, all I can say is Frozen 2, okay?
I'm with
you. Toy Story 4. I don't think there's all that much difference. I mean, the biggest thing, the most important thing is that they do something to make it still entertaining and still good. There's nothing worse than when a franchise dips into the well too many times and it's just, there is a law of diminishing returns. And so I do fear, where can they go next? Because based on the amount of money these Jumanji films make, you can be pretty darn sure that the next level is not the last level when it comes to Jumanji.
Well, good one.
There you go.
I'm with you. All right, the film we both saw this week was actually, was chasing awards, because the director usually does. Clint Eastwood, I don't think it's going to win any. It'll probably get nominated maybe for one. Because we're talking about Richard Jewell. Clint Eastwood, it never sat well with him that everybody heard the name Richard Jewell because we were told in Atlanta, the Olympics, 1996, that Richard Jewell, the hero, the security guard who found the pipe bomb in the backpack and saved a bunch of lives, we were told it was him. We were told he did it. And only later, only much later, when people had tuned off and tuned out, he didn't do it. He's an innocent man. More people, and I ran into this. My last name is Jewell, not related, spelled differently. Every now and then I'll run into someone like, are you related to that Olympic bomber guy, Richard Jewell? I'm like, A, no, different spelling. B, he didn't do it. He's an innocent man. And if only they had put in the effort to clear his name as they did to smear it, we probably wouldn't have a film and Clint Eastwood wouldn't be so upset and has an axe to grind against two specific entities. He has an axe to grind against the FBI who... we have a profile. We got to file the profile, and Richard Jewell fits the profile. And the media, specifically the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. And here's where I want you to dive into this. And for all of you who don't know, and most of our listeners do know, you have a history, an experience, a breadth of knowledge in journalism. Do you have strong feelings about how Clint Eastwood specifically portrays the lead reporter from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution? Is he right? Is he wrong?
Oh, I mean, I think yes, he is both right and wrong. Where I think he goes really wrong is that he names her. You know, he's using this real life reporter.
Because she wrote it. She did it.
Kathy Scruggs, but she's no longer around. She died several years ago. She's not around to defend herself. And the Atlanta Journal-Constitution is saying, look, this is not an accurate portrayal, and you'd better put a disclaimer on your film saying, there's some creative license taken with this film. And she's portrayed Olivia Wilde, who's very good, portrays this reporter as this boozy, floozy of a reporter who is a crime beat reporter who essentially, seduces law enforcement personnel into leaking information about their investigation. And John Hamm plays a composite character who does not necessarily exist in literal form. And so I had a huge problem with the Kathy Scruggs character being specifically named and portrayed in this way, whereas the law enforcement character kind of gets off the hook by not being a real person who is named, who would probably have huge issues with this particular film. And I do know I was living in Atlanta in 1996. I was working the Olympic Games in 1996. I worked for CNN probably during that time of the Richard Jewell investigation. I remember speaking to members of the ATF about the investigation. There is a very cozy relationship, but sometimes it's very necessary between law enforcement and media in order to get information out there. And so I think the saddest part for me about this film is that for the most part, it's a very good film and the performances are really good. It's an interesting story. Richard Jewell deserves to get that kind of film portrayal where his name is cleared so that people don't automatically associate him as just the prime suspect, but that he goes back to being known as the hero. Richard Jewell died in, I think, 2007. He was only 44. This whole investigation ruined his life. It was a combination of factors, a lot of people to blame. But I do have a lot of friends in Atlanta. I have a lot of friends in media. And while I do feel like in some ways we were sort of complicit, there's a larger context for what went on at the time. And so I'm very conflicted about this film because I know a lot of people are only focusing on the controversy surrounding the AJC reporter, and they're not, you know, they're not really giving due credit to the film as a whole. And so I think that's a shame. It's something Clint Eastwood could have easily sidestepped if he had made a few alterations. And then I think this film would have gotten, would have just been better, you know, more well-received overall.
The Atlanta Journal-Constitution is threatening significant legal action against Warner Brothers, saying you do need to put a disclaimer up front about the Kathy Scruggs character. And Warner Brothers shot back, "We defend everything Clint Eastwood did. Besides, there's the standard disclaimer at the end of the credits that say certain characters and events may have some dramatic license involved." Personally, I actually thought Olivia Wilde overdid it. I think she overacted Kathy.
I think so, too.
I know people, well, I don't know them, I follow them on Twitter, who boycott Clint Eastwood films on principle. They say Clint Eastwood is anti-woman and anti-people of color. It's not just that he was talking to an empty chair that time at the Republican National Convention. Right. It's interviews he has given, defending Trump, defending the policies, and using specific female body language describing our political correct culture. Clint Eastwood does not like that. He makes no bones about it. Therefore, he alienates a slice of the pie of the audience who just don't go see his films. They are missing out a little bit on Richard Jewell. I think they're missing out, most importantly, on Paul Walter Hauser. He plays Richard Jewell, and he does it with that accent, that Georgia accent. There's a bomb in Centennial Park. It actually reminds me of how he played Shane Eckert in I, Tonya. They puff themselves up a lot. They're the most important person in the room. They live in a fantasy world. They both do. I liked him more than Kathy Bates. She's the only one getting nominated because she's got some crying scenes. Sam Rockwell's the lawyer. Meh. John Hamm always plays an FBI agent. There's the surrounding is less than the central character. I would only say watch it for the central character, Richard Jewell, and just a reminder and tell all your friends when they bring it up, he's innocent.
I disagree. I actually think I found the heart of this film to be in the relationships that you see between Richard Jewell and his mother, Bobby, who is still alive, played by Kathy Bates, who I think Kathy Bates is very deserving of the supporting actress nomination. I certainly put her into that category. I love Sam Rockwell, and he plays the other true defender of Richard Jewell and really his only friend, and as the his defense lawyer. And so I think it's that combination that makes this film work. What's really interesting, though, is that Jonah Hill and Leo DiCaprio are producers on this film. They were originally attached to play the roles of Jewell and his lawyer. I can actually visualize how it might have had... Somehow, I think if those two had been playing it, as opposed to a relative unknown in Paul Walter Hauser. I mean, this is his first real lead role. Him playing Tonya Harding's bodyguard in I, Tonya, he was sort of this doofus And he was very good in that, too. So while he's really good here and he's very good at sort of picking up on the traits that really did bring that suspicion by the public and law enforcement onto Jewel as a potential suspect, he's good. But I really kind of suspect that Jonah Hill and Leo DiCaprio might have made it a bigger draw.
I'm not as sold as you are on that. Leo DiCaprio would be just way too good looking for this movie. because, you know, Paul Walter Hauser plays Richard Jewell as, he's off-putting. And I think he was in real life too. He plays him almost on the spectrum. None of us, and even though we champion his name and want to clear it, none of us would have been friends with Richard Jewell in real life. We just wouldn't. He seems like a kind of really far-right radical kind of guy. And that's fine, you know, he still didn't blow up the park. He's sympathetic to a point.
Yeah, no, absolutely. There are still reasons, and that's where I think the context of the time and the place and what had happened in Los Angeles Olympics, where a law enforcement officer really had, like, you know, raised suspicion about some possible bomb, but he was really just doing it in order to play the hero. So there were all these other factors that really did come into play. But I think the biggest thing that has to really be reinforced as this film is discussed is that you can't just blame journalists, you can't blame law enforcement, you gotta blame Eric Robert Rudolph, the guy who actually was the bomber. And none of this would have happened if he had not planted the bomb. And if you did not have cooperation and the efforts of law enforcement and media, Eric Robert Rudolph could very well still be out there on the loose today, killing people with his serial bombing. And so I think it's just as important to say, yes, remember, Richard Jewell was not the bomber. He really was this hero security guard who was a bit of a schlub who got himself, you know, he didn't do much to help himself, really. But Eric Robert Rudolph is the true perpetrator here. And people just have to kind of remember both of those names and not get them confused and not automatically think that that Richard Jewell is the only name associated as the perpetrator of the bombing, because he was not. He was a victim. And just like many others were of Eric Robert Rudolph.
Well, last week we plugged that our main film critic group, the Washington, D.C. Area Film Critics Association, had awards coming up, and we did it. We nominated, we voted, and the gauntlet has once again been passed for another year. I did better this year. I usually nominate my top five pictures and get zero. I got two this year.
Oh, you're kidding. I got 11.
I mean, just for picture. Just like for, you know, two. Two of my five best picture picks got in this year.
Picture.
You know what I mean?
Okay.
And naturally, my favorite film of the year, Jojo Rabbit, did not get nominated. It got nominated for some fluff awards and one for Beth Youth Performance from Roman Griffin Davis. Therefore, I ended up, for Best Picture, voting for Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, which did not win.
Well, I wanted to vote for Ford versus Ferrari, which did not even make the cut for the final five in our voting, which really frustrated me. And the fact that Parasite seems to be the darling of all, including our particular voting body, is very distressing to me, because I voted for it for Best Foreign Film, but it won the WAFCA Award for Best Film and Best Director in Bong Joon-ho. And I just think that, I don't know, I think there's some groupthink going on with the
I remember
love
when
of
we
Parasite.
Watched Parasite together, mm-hmm. and I kept punching in the arm a little bit because of the twists and turns and how violent it got. But we enjoyed it. It's a good movie.
Yeah, that's why I had no problem voting for it for Best Foreign Film. But I do not... I just don't get it. You know, it's good, it's interesting, but there are too many other films that I liked more, and I would have rather, just like you, seen Jojo Rabbit win over Parasite. At least that one made it, you know, did that make it into
No, Jojo Rabbit was
so
not
none
nominated
of our
as part
favorite,
of the top
yeah,
five.
Yeah, so our no. favorite films did not make it into the
but
top
But I'm used
five.
To that. None of my top five ever make it in. But my actress, my best actress, my number one actress, mm-hmm. not only got nominated, but one, Lupita Nyong'o for us way back in the day.
And we flagged that way back in the day when we reviewed Us. And we're like, we have to remember, come award season, how good she is in this film. And folks who don't like horror films and shied away from Us are going to be kind of surprised when they keep hearing her name in the mix for Best Actress. But she was that good.
Well, she was nominated for a SAG Award. Mm-hmm. I believe she's nominated for Critics' Choice. Maybe not the Golden Globe, though.
Yeah, but she definitely, she was my pick, too. So we both scored a win with that one. And I also had picked Brad Pitt for Once Upon a Time in Hollywood for Best Supporting Actor. And he also got the nod in the WAFCO Awards.
I did not vote for him. I actually don't remember who I voted for him for that, that category. But for Sibling Award Best Supporting Actress, my number one got nominated, Scarlett Johansson for Jojo Rabbit, but lost the one I really did not want to win, J-Lo.
Yeah, I mean, I think Scarlett Johansson kind of got, I think she suffered from the fact that she was too good in too many films this year. I think maybe people just were sort of...
I think people just like... they're so impressed that J-Lo swung around a pole.
I think, you know, when we saw Scarlett Johansson in both Marriage Story as a lead actress and in Jojo Rabbit as a phenomenal supporting actress, you see this range. You don't get to see that kind of range. J-Lo is more of a, you know, just sort of a stunt victory. And this, it's just kind of sad to me because I just feel that... that Scarlett Johansson packed way more of a punch in what really was a supporting role. And so I was sort of disappointed to not see her get the nod.
I'm not disappointed in Best Actor. I'm not surprised one bit. It went to Adam Driver for Marriage Story. His name will be in the top two through the Academy Awards in February. But I didn't vote for him. I voted for Leonardo DiCaprio.
I did too. And I wanted Christian Bale to be in the mix, and he was not. I do think Ford versus Ferrari was not seen by enough of the WAFCA members.
I disagree.
Voting.
I think everybody saw it, and they were like, it's okay.
I disagree.
No,
wait
a minute. It was nominated for Best Editing, I believe.
Best Editing. It won Best Editing. It did win Best Editing. But I was just disappointed that it didn't get a few more nominations in there. But I did like Leo DiCaprio.
That seems to be the standard excuse when a film either gets shut out or at least of the major categories. It's always, well, obviously that guild didn't see it. Everybody saw Ford versus Ferrari. Everybody saw it.
I don't think so.
And most of them, I think, were like
our friend Eddie.
And
he saw
wasn't
it after.
That big a deal.
He said he was disappointed that he saw it
like,
after
we did
the
not
awards.
Nominate Bombshell. Not one. And Twitter exploded saying, well, they must not have seen it.
Yes, we saw Bombshell.
We didn't vote for it.
And that one's out in limited release this week, but we'll talk about it next week in more detail. But but then there were some that were pretty obvious. Knives Out, I was pretty sure that our body was going to vote for that for Best Ensemble because it really is one of those films where the ensemble made the movie. And whereas a lot of these films had really good ensemble casts, they might have been good films even with different actors in those roles. Knives Out, I'm not sure, would have been nearly as good if it didn't have just such a stellar ensemble.
The biggest crime was we have this weird category that nobody else has, Best Motion Capture Performance. And there were two nominees. Thanos, Josh Brolin, who was also probably nominated last year for Infinity War, won. He beat Rosa Salazar from Alita: Battle Angel, which is ridiculous.
Although that is absolutely a case where I don't think enough of members of WAFCA saw Alita: Battle Angel. I think they did.
You're probably right.
And so that, I believe, really was.
We didn't get a screener for Alita, so you had to have seen it.
And I don't think that many people did. And so that got lost.
Well, shame
because
on
you're
them.
Right. I absolutely went with Salazar for motion capture performance because she really was. She made that movie a really fascinating watch. And so you're right. That was probably the most shocking for me, because it was only two.
My favorite animated film didn't even get nominated. I Lost My Body.
That was a weird one. I'm not surprised there. I mean, Toy Story 4 That was pretty much
a
shoo-in.
Yeah, but it should at least got nominated.
And then Tony Hale for voicing Forky.
I actually voted for Tony Hale just because I was mad at I Lost My Body. So I was like, I'm going to give it to Tony Hale.
I'd forgotten that Tony Hale even was, you know, I forgot all about his character. And so when I saw that he won, I was okay with it. Because
how
he
you forget
really
his
was.
Character. He was Forky was the movie.
I don't know. I just Toy Story 4. Well, I remembered that I really liked it. I just for some reason he just fell off my radar, and I think I was focused more on Billy Eichner for The Lion King for his voice. I thought he was just so much fun in that one. He was the only fun thing in that one. So, and my biggest. I think the thing that I was most pleased about really was Apollo 11 winning for Best Documentary, because that's the only documentary that I actually watched and enjoyed multiple times. And it's the combination of the timing of the 50th anniversary of the moon landing and this incredibly impressive documentary being put together to coincide with that. To me, there was really, while there are a lot of other really good documentaries, it's a tough category this year. For Sama was probably the most moving documentary.
I voted for it.
But Apollo 11, to me, was that total package documentary that blew me away. And so I was really glad that I was kind of worried. I didn't know if that was going to remain in the consciousness enough, and it did win Best Doc.
I was happy to see at least For Sama get nominated. I don't think Apollo 11's actually going to win the Oscar, though.
I hope
it
does.
It didn't have that feeling.
I don't know. I think it didn't, but now this kind of reinstored a little faith for me.
The one category I thought Jojo Rabbit actually could win was Adapted Screenplay. It's so well written. And it lost to the 19,000th remake of Little Women.
I mean, how can you possibly compete with Louisa May Alcott with adapting anything?
You've got to be kidding me.
You know, I think it was part of this. People really like Greta Gerwig, and they like Noah Baumbach. And so both Noah Baumbach won Best Original Screenplay for Marriage Story, and then you've got his girlfriend Greta Gerwig winning Best Adapted Screenplay for Little Women.
But did you notice she got nominated for director?
Yes.
And he did not.
Yeah, I did notice that. and it Little Women's very good. And so, you know, it's I'm not 100% shocked by that, but it was a tough category. I actually think Best Adapted Screenplay is one of the toughest categories.
Come on. Both Jojo Rabbit and The Two Popes are way better screenplays than Little Women.
I don't know. I mean, but it's adapting something that's such a classic. And if you don't screw it up, it's a victory. And I do think Best Cinematography was an obvious one. Yeah, 1917.
Just wait, folks. I know you haven't seen 1917 yet, but you're about to have your mind blown.
Yeah, I mean, that was the easiest.
That's going
to
sweep technical awards at the Oscars. It's going to sweep them.
Possibly, although I do hope Ford versus Ferrari does stick it. You know, I think Best Editing was a valid.
No, 1917, for obvious reasons, probably won't even be nominated for Best Editing. But the two sound categories, visual effects and cinematography, I would almost call it a lock.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I did Once Upon a Time in Hollywood got the nod for Best Production Design, and I agreed with that one too, because that really was...
I voted for that.
That production design really was critical.
I wasn't around in 69, but I believe that's what it looked like.
And I, you know, it's old Hollywood, and it felt right, and so I was glad to see that at least get a little bit of love, and I was just relieved that The Irishman didn't pick up any of our major awards, because I just, you know, did not feel that it was worthy of a 3.5-hour epic that felt to me like most other mob movies. It got a lot of nominations, but it didn't win the top prize.
And what was the no-brainer award for Best Portrayal of Washington, D.C.?
It was The Report, another one with Adam Driver. And there was absolutely no competition for this award. It's a struggle every year for, what movie has the best portrayal of Washington? And when you saw The Report, you immediately went, well, okay, finally we have a movie that can fit that category. That was definitely, that wins the no-brainer award.
All right, well, let's end on a quirky item in the news. Every year, I see this every year, the National Film Registry is released. 25 films make the registry, and they're required to do this to fulfill the National Film Preservation Act. where the Library of Congress are going to take these 25 films and they're going to preserve them forever in pristine condition. So when whatever apocalypse happens, whenever nuclear war happens, these big, you know, growing list of films will survive the end times, will survive Avengers Endgame. And, you know, it's growing now since it's 25 every year. And it's you would think they would lean towards the old films. And they did somewhat this year. The oldest one is from 1903. It's called Immigrants Landing at Ellis Island. And there's some from the teens and the 20s and the 30s. But I'm noticing there's a lot more now from the 80s. And there's even a couple from the 2000s already popping up on this list. I wanted to ask you, when you saw this list, what was the number one film you saw? Like, yes, that made the National Film Registry and it will be alive forever.
Well, you got to remember that these are supposed to be deemed culturally, historically, or aesthetically significant.
Mm.
I don't understand exactly how that criteria is supposed to be met. This is a very weird mix, the 25. I've never heard of most of them. So
well, they're old.
Really
a lot
hard.
Of them are old.
But they're even, some of the ones that aren't like really, really old. But I, you know, I'm surprised. I don't know. Films like Clerks, yeah, it's good. But is it? Does it need to be in a time capsule for
Yes, it
history?
Does, because it is both culturally and historically significant. Clerks
know.
Blew up Sundance, and it said anyone from New Jersey, from the Quick Stop in New Jersey, can get a film in Sundance and become a superstar director.
I mean, I live, also on the list, Real Women Have Curves. I love that movie.
Blows my mind.
Do I think it's historically... aesthetically
no, I think they're saying it's culturally significant, but I disagree. It's from 2002. It barely made a ripple, and nobody talks about it anymore.
It's a good movie, but I was kind of surprised to see that one on the list. And so, yeah, it's a very
well. I'm very happy to see Amadeus on there.
Yeah,
that film should be preserved,
mm-hmm.
And I'm very happy to see Platoon on there.
Right.
My WTF inclusion is I love it. Why well, I like it because it's got one of the best soundtracks ever made.
Yes.
But why is Purple Rain being preserved?
I do not think that Purple Rain needed to be preserved, other than to just preserve the memory and legacy of Prince.
It's probably why it happened.
But that's a stretch, man.
I mean, Morris Day and the Time just got enshrined.
A lot of these are really a stretch, but. I don't know how they're making these picks, but at 25, and I would say I recognize the names of maybe
like
10 of them.
They've been doing this for a while, so the big ones, they're already on there.
Yeah.
But, you know, discussions like this happen every year. Well, how have you not included this yet? And how could you include this? And, you know, that's what lists are supposed to do. They're supposed to become wedge issues and make us fight one another.
Sure. I mean, I'm really curious now to go find Emigrants Landing at Ellis Island.
Actually, I've seen a clip of that.
It's from 1903. Good. But you figure it's from 1903 and it's only now being deemed relevant and culturally and
well, obviously, it wasn't top of the box office in 1903.
So, yeah. So I'm challenging everyone to go seek out the 1903 Emigrants Landing at Ellis Island film to tell me
no one's gonna do that, by the way. Maybe it's on YouTube.
I don't know. I bet you it is, so yeah. We shall see.
Someone let us know. Someone look it up on YouTube and let us know. I don't feel like doing it. Very quick recap, because we only talked about two movies. Jumanji: The Next Level.
You should have gone to see it, because you would have enjoyed it.
That's your review? I should have gone to see it?
I don't think it will be added to the National Film Registry anytime soon, but it's just an entertaining ride. But I do think you really need to have seen the first one to maximize your enjoyment of the sequel.
I think you should. I think everybody should go see Richard Jewell, not because it's that good. It's because people are fighting about it, and you know what? Take a side, because this isn't going to die anytime soon.
No, I agree. I do take exception with people sort of boycotting films and feeling that that they have to take a stance one way or another without actually seeing it. And so I kind of feel that you should give it a go, see it, and then take your stand.
And it is historically accurate. I have seen crowds that large all do the Macarena.
That's true. Yes, it took me back for sure to 1996. And so I think it's there's enough good there's it's worth seeing, even though there is some debate to be had around this film. And then
So next week we have We have a big deal next week. Uh-huh. Star Wars is coming out.
We have a double feature day.
Well, you're going to do a double feature.
How you can skip Cats.
Remember how much grief you gave me that I never saw Fiddler? Guess if I've seen Cats.
I know. But next week, we actually have a double feature day that includes Star Wars in the afternoon, followed by Cats
and
in the evening.
Your triple feature, because we all know how much you love you some Terrence Malick.
Yes, I don't know if I will watch A Hidden Life. Perhaps if you're not going to watch Cats, I'm guessing you will watch Terrence Malick's A Hidden Life. Am I correct?
I'm definitely going to watch it. I actually haven't seen it yet.
So that will be the trade-off. And we will finally get to talk a little more significantly about Bombshell, which, again, has quite the cast and is the Me Too movie of the moment.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to A Hidden Life, just like you.
Yeah, right. Because, you know, I love my Terrence Malick movies. Oh, my goodness.
And I think we're doing something a little bit different, too.
Yeah, I'm going to do a little preview of a ESPN 30 for 30 short documentary called Subject to Review, which I believe has something to do with sort of all the new technology that is used in tennis.
You know, we reviewed a 30 for 30 before, the Redskins 1987 strike-shortened season, and we've reviewed tennis documentaries. So remember the John McEnroe weird thing we watched?
Yeah.
So put them together, and we're on the ball for this.
That's right. So it'll be a fun week.
All right. Well, thank you very much for listening to this episode of The Cinema Clash. I'm Charlie Jewell.
I'm Hannah Buchdahl.
Thank you.
Take care.
The Cinema Clash with Charlie Jewell and Hannah Buchdahl is heard twice each weekend at 5:15 on Saturday and 12:15 on Sunday afternoon. Join us again next time for The Cinema Clash.